as a top to a, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board. Oh. 11, oh, 11,
and most
11,
of the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on The Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
The clerk, government business, notice number one, motion offering an apology to Australia's Indigenous peoples.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I move that today we honour the Indigenous peoples of this land, the oldest continuing cultures in human history. We reflect on their past mistreatment. We reflect in particular on the mistreatment of those who were stolen generations. This blemished chapter in our national history. The time has now come for the nation to turn a new page. A new page in Australia's history by righting the wrongs of the past and so moving forward with confidence to the future. We apologise for the laws and policies of successive parliaments and governments that have inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on these our fellow Australians. We apologise especially for the removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families, their communities and their country. For the pain, suffering and hurt of these stolen generations, their descendants and for their families left behind, we say sorry. To the mothers and the fathers, the brothers and the sisters, for the breaking up of families and communities, we say sorry. And for the indignity and degradation thus inflicted on a proud people and a proud culture, we say sorry. We, the Parliament of Australia, respectfully request that this apology be received in the spirit in which it is offered, as part of the healing of the nation. For the future, we take heart, resolving that this new page in the history of our great continent can now be written. We today take this first step by acknowledging the past and laying claim to a future that embraces all Australians. A future where this Parliament resolves that the injustices of the past must never, never happen again. A future where we harness the determination of all Australians, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to close the gap that lies between us in life expectancy, educational achievement and economic opportunity. A future where we embrace the possibility of new solutions to enduring problems where old approaches have failed. A future based on mutual respect, mutual resolve and mutual responsibility. A future where all Australians, whatever their origins, are truly equal partners with equal opportunities and with an equal stake in shaping the next chapter in the history of this great country, Australia.
All right, everybody, welcome aboard Foxed Up for, pardon me, it's the third, fourth, fifth time I've listened to that, and it still just grabs me. That was Prime Minister Rudd tabling the apology to the Indigenous people of Australia. And it is a monumentous day in this country for these people, all these children who were forcibly removed from their families, many for no reason other than they were black. And these people, many of them still don't know who their families were or are. Some have found their families. But this hopefully opens up a new chapter in Australian history for the wounds to be healed, if that is possible. Now, we've got a lot of audio to get through in the show today. It's going to take up most of the show, but I didn't want to edit any of this down because I think editing it would have been not doing it justice. So we're going to move on to, there were two speeches, first by the Prime Minister after he tabled the motion, and this was approved unanimously by both sides of politics. And then the follow-up by Dr. Nelson, the leader of the opposition, who had his back turned on him by those in attendance when he veered from the heart of what this day was about. However, the beginning of his statements were beautiful, without a doubt. So, without wasting any more time, I'd like to play. This is about 25 minutes. Sit back and listen to a very eloquent man explain why this needed to happen. If you'd please run the audio of Mr. Rudd's speech, Bob.
Mr. Speaker, there comes a time in the history of nations when their peoples must become fully reconciled to their past if they are to go forward with confidence to embrace their future. Our nation, Australia, has reached such a time, and that is why the Parliament is today here assembled, to deal with this unfinished business of the nation, to remove a great stain from the nation's soul, and in a true spirit of reconciliation, to open a new chapter in the history of this great land, Australia. Mr. Speaker, last year I made a commitment to the Australian people that if we formed the next government of the Commonwealth, we would in Parliament say sorry to the stolen generations. Mr. Speaker, today I honour that commitment. I said we would do so early in the life of the new Parliament. Mr. Speaker, again today, I honour that commitment by doing so at the commencement of this, the 42nd Parliament of the Commonwealth. Because the time has come, well and truly come, for all peoples of our great country, for all citizens of our great Commonwealth, for all Australians, those who are Indigenous and those who are not, to come together, to reconcile, and together build a new future for our nation. Some have asked why I apologise. Let me begin to answer by telling the Parliament just a little of one person's story. An elegant, eloquent and wonderful woman in her 80s, full of life, full of funny stories, despite what has happened in her life's journey. A woman who has travelled a long way to be with us today. a member of the Stolen Generation, who shared some of her story with me when I called round to see her just a few days ago. Nana Nungalau Fijo, as she prefers to be called, was born in the late 1920s. She remembers her earliest childhood days living with her family and her community in a bush camp just outside Tennant Creek. She remembers the love and the warmth and the kinship of those days long ago, including traditional dancing around the campfire at night. She loved the dancing. She remembers once getting into strife when, as a four-year-old girl, she insisted on dancing with the male tribal elders, rather than just sitting and watching the men, as the girls were supposed to do. But then, sometime around 1932, when she was about four, she remembers the coming of the welfare men. Her family had feared that day and had dug holes in the creek bank where the children could run and hide. What they hadn't expected was that the white welfare men didn't come alone. They brought a truck, they brought two white men and an Aboriginal stockman on horseback, cracking his stockwhip. The kids were found. They ran for their mothers, screaming, but they couldn't get away. They were herded and piled onto the back of the truck. Tears flowing, her mum tried clinging to the sides of the truck as her children were taken away to the bungalow in Alice, all in the name of protection. A few years later, government policy changed. Now the children would be handed over to the missions to be cared for by the churches. But which church would care for them? The kids were simply told to line up in three lines. Nana Fijo and her sisters stood in the middle line, her older brother and cousin on her left. Those on the left were told that they had become Catholics, those in the middle, Methodists, and those on the right, Church of England. That's how the complex questions of post-Reformation theology were resolved in the Australian outback in the 1930s. It was as crude as that. She and her sister were sent to a Methodist mission on Goulburn Island and then Croker Island. Her Catholic brother was sent to work at a cattle station and her cousin to a Catholic mission. Nana Fijo's family had been broken up for a second time. She stayed at the mission until after the war, when she was allowed to leave for a pre-arranged job as a domestic in Darwin. She was 16. Nana Fijo never saw her mum again. After she left the mission, her brother let her know that her mum had died years before, a broken woman fretting for the children that had literally been ripped away from her. I asked Nana Fijo what she would have me say today about her story. She thought for a few moments, then said that what I should say today was that all mothers are important. And she added, families, keeping them together is very important. It's a good thing that you are surrounded by love and that love is passed down the generations. That's what gives you happiness. As I left later on, Nana Fijo took one of my staff aside, wanting to make sure that I wasn't too hard on the Aboriginal stockman who'd hunted those kids down all those years ago. The stockman had found her again decades later, this time himself to say sorry. And remarkably, extraordinarily, she had forgiven him. Nana Fijo's is just one story. There are thousands, tens of thousands of them. Stories of forced separation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their mums and dads over the better part of a century. Some of these stories are graphically told in Bringing Them Home, the report commissioned in 1995 by Prime Minister Keating and received in 1997 by Prime Minister Howard. There is something terribly primal about these first-hand accounts. The pain is searing. It screams from the pages. The hurt, the humiliation, the degradation, and the sheer brutality of the act of physically separating a mother from her children is a deep assault on our senses and on our most elemental humanity. These stories cry out to be heard. They cry out for an apology. Instead, from the nation's parliament, there has been a stony and stubborn and deafening silence for more than a decade. A view that somehow we, the Parliament, should suspend our most basic instincts of what is right and what is wrong. A view that instead we should look for any pretext to push this great wrong to one side, to leave it languishing with the historians, the academics, and the cultural warriors, as if the stolen generations are little more than an interesting sociological phenomenon. But the stolen generations are not intellectual curiosities. They are human beings. Human beings who have been damaged deeply by the decisions of parliaments and governments. But as of today, the time for denial, the time for delay, has at last come to an end. Mr. Speaker, the nation is demanding of its political leadership to take us forward. Mr. Speaker, decency, human decency, universal human decency, demands that the nation now steps forward to right an historical wrong. And that is what we are doing in this place today. But should there still be doubts as to why we must now act, let the Parliament reflect for a moment on the following facts. That between 1910 and 1970, between 10 and 30% of Indigenous children were forcibly taken from their mothers and fathers. That as a result, up to 50,000 children were forcibly taken from their families. That this was the product of the deliberate, calculated policies of the state, as reflected in the explicit powers given to them under statute. That this policy was taken to such extremes by some in administrative authority that the forced extractions of children of so-called mixed lineage was seen as part of a broader policy of dealing with, quote, the problem of the Aboriginal population, unquote. One of the most notorious examples of this approach was from the Northern Territory Protector of Natives, who stated, and I quote, generally by the fifth and invariably by the sixth generation, all native characteristics of the Australian Aborigine are eradicated. The problem of our half-castes, to quote the Protector, will quickly be eliminated by the complete disappearance of the black race and the swift submergence of their progeny in the white, unquote. The West Australian Protector of Natives expressed not dissimilar views, expounding them at length in Canberra in 1937 at the first national conference on Indigenous affairs that brought together the Commonwealth and State Protectors of Natives. These are uncomfortable things to be brought out into the light. They are not pleasant. They are profoundly disturbing. But we must acknowledge these facts if we are to deal once and for all with the argument that the policy of generic forced separation was somehow well motivated, justified by its historical context, and as a result, unworthy of any apology today. Then we come to the argument of intergenerational responsibility, also used by some to argue against giving an apology today. But let us remember the fact that the forced removal of Aboriginal children was happening as late as the early 1970s. The 1970s is not exactly a point in remote antiquity. There are still serving members of this Parliament who were first elected to this place in the early 1970s. It is well within the adult memory span of many of us. The uncomfortable truth for us all is that the parliaments of the nation, individually and collectively, enacted statutes and delegated authority under those statutes that made the forced removal of children on racial grounds fully lawful. There is a further reason for an apology as well. It is that reconciliation is in fact an expression of a core value of our nation. And that value is a fair go for all. There is a deep and abiding belief in the Australian community that for the stolen generations, there was no fair go at all. And there is a pretty basic Aussie belief that says it's time to put right this most outrageous of wrongs. It is for these reasons, Mr. Speaker, quite apart from concerns of fundamental human decency, that the governments and parliaments of this nation must make this apology. Because, put simply, the laws that our parliaments enacted made the stolen generations possible. We, the parliaments of the nation, are ultimately responsible. Not those who gave effect to our laws. The problem lay with the laws themselves. As has been said of settler societies elsewhere, we are the bearers of many blessings from our ancestors, and therefore we must also be the bearer of their burdens as well. Therefore, for our nation, the course of action is clear. Therefore, for our people, the course of action is clear. And that is to deal now with what has become one of the darkest chapters in Australia's history. In doing so, we are doing more than contending with the facts, the evidence, and the often rancorous public debate. In doing so, we are also wrestling with our own soul. This is not, as some would argue, a black armband view of history. It's just the truth, the cold, confronting, uncomfortable truth. Facing with it, dealing with it, moving on from it. And until we fully confront that truth, there will always be a shadow hanging over us and our future as a fully united and fully reconciled people. It's time to reconcile. It's time to recognise the injustices of the past. It's time to say sorry. It's time to move forward together. To the stolen generations, I say the following. As Prime Minister of Australia, I am sorry. On behalf of the Government of Australia, I am sorry. On behalf of the Parliament of Australia, I am sorry. And I offer you this apology without qualification. We apologise for the hurt, the pain and suffering we, the Parliament, have caused you by the laws that previous parliaments have enacted. We apologise for the indignity, the degradation and the humiliation these laws embodied. We offer this apology to the mothers, the fathers, the brothers, the sisters, the families and the communities whose lives were ripped apart by the actions of successive governments under successive parliaments. In making this apology, I would also like to speak personally to the members of the stolen generation and their families. Those here today, so many of you. To those listening across the nation, from Yuendumu in the central west of the Northern Territory to Yabara in North Queensland and to Pitjantjatjara in South Australia. I know that in offering this apology on behalf of the Government and the Parliament, there is nothing I can say today that can take away the pain you have suffered personally. Whatever words I speak today, I cannot undo that. Words alone are not that powerful. Grief is a very personal thing. I say to non-Indigenous Australians listening today, those who may not fully understand why we are doing what we are doing is so important. I ask those non-Indigenous Australians to imagine for a moment if this had happened to you. I say to honourable members here present, imagine if this had happened to us. Imagine the crippling effect. Imagine how hard it would be to forgive. But my proposal is this. If the apology we extend today is accepted in the spirit of reconciliation in which it is offered, we can today resolve together that there be a new beginning for Australia. And it is to such a new beginning that I believe the nation is now calling us. Australians are a passionate lot. We're also a very practical lot. For us, symbolism is important. But unless the great symbolism of reconciliation is accompanied by an even greater substance, it is little more than a clanging gong. It's not sentiment that makes history, it's our actions that make history. Today's apology, however inadequate, is aimed at righting past wrongs. It is also aimed at building a bridge between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians, a bridge based on a real respect rather than a thinly veiled contempt. Our challenge for the future is now to cross that bridge and in so doing embrace a new partnership between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. Embracing as part of that partnership expanded link-up and other critical services to help the stolen generations to trace their families, if at all possible, and to provide dignity to their lives. But the core of this partnership for the future is closing the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians on life expectancy, educational achievement and employment opportunities. This new partnership on closing the gap will set concrete targets for the future. Within a decade, to halve the widening gap in literacy, numeracy and employment outcomes and opportunities for Indigenous children. Within a decade, to halve the appalling gap in infant mortality rates between Indigenous and non-Indigenous children. And within a generation, to close the equally appalling 17-year life gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous when it comes to overall life expectancy. The truth is, a business-as-usual approach towards Indigenous Australians is not working. Most old approaches are not working. We need a new beginning. A new beginning which contains real measures of policy success or policy failure. A new beginning, a new partnership on closing the gap, with sufficient flexibility not to insist on a one-size-fits-all approach for each of the hundreds of remote and regional Indigenous communities across the country, but instead allows flexible, tailored, local approaches to achieve commonly agreed national objectives that lie at the core of our proposed new partnership. And a new beginning that draws intelligently on the experiences of new policy settings across the nation. However, unless we as a parliament set a destination for the nation, we have no clear point to guide our policy, our programs, or our purpose, no central organising principle. So let us resolve today to begin with the little children, a fitting place to start on this day of apology for the stolen generations. Let us resolve over the next 5 years to have every Indigenous 4-year-old in a remote Aboriginal community enrolled and attending a proper early childhood education centre or opportunity and engaged in proper pre-literacy and pre-numeracy programs. Let us resolve to build new educational opportunities for these little ones year by year, step by step, following the completion of their crucial preschool year. Let us resolve to use this systematic approach to building future educational opportunities for Indigenous children, to provide proper primary and preventative health care for the same children, to begin the task of rolling back the obscenity that we find today in infant mortality rates in remote Indigenous communities, up to 4 times higher than in other communities. None of this will be easy. Most of it will be hard, very hard. But none of it is impossible. And all of it is achievable with clear goals, clear thinking, and by placing an absolute premium on respect, cooperation, and mutual responsibility as the guiding principles of this new partnership on closing the gap. The mood of the nation is for reconciliation now between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. The mood of the nation on Indigenous policy and politics is now very simple. The nation is calling on us, the politicians, to move beyond our infantile bickering, our point scoring, and our mindlessly partisan politics and elevate this one, at least this one core area of national responsibility, to a rare position beyond the partisan divide. Surely this is the spirit, the unfulfilled spirit, the 1967 referendum. Surely, at least from this day forward, we should give it a go. So let me take this one step further, to take what some may see as a piece of political posturing and make a practical proposal to the opposition on this. On this day, the first full sitting day of the new Parliament. I said before the election, the nation needed a kind of war cabinet on parts of Indigenous policy because the challenges are too great and the consequences too great to just allow it all to become a political football as it's been so often in the past. I therefore propose a joint policy commission to be led by the Leader of the Opposition and myself, and with a mandate to develop and implement, to begin with, an effective housing strategy for remote communities over the next 5 years. It will be consistent with the government's policy framework, a new partnership for closing the gap. If this commission operates well, I then propose that it work on the further task of constitutional recognition of the First Australians, consistent with the long-standing platform commitments of my party and the pre-election position of the opposition. This would probably be desirable in any event because unless such a proposition was absolutely bipartisan, it would fail at a referendum. As I said before, the time has come for new approaches to enduring problems. And working constructively together on such defined projects, I believe, would meet with the support of the nation. It's time for fresh ideas to fashion the nation's future. Mr. Speaker, today the Parliament has come together to right a great wrong. We have come together to deal with the past so that we might fully embrace the future. And we have had sufficient audacity of faith to advance a pathway to that future with arms extended rather than with fists still clenched. So let us seize the day. Let it not become a moment of mere sentimental reflection. Let us take it with both hands and allow this day of national reconciliation, to become one of those rare moments in which we might just be able to transform the way in which the nation thinks about itself, whereby the injustice administered to these stolen generations, in the name of these our parliaments, causes all of us to reappraise at the deepest level of our beliefs the real possibility of reconciliation writ large. Reconciliation across all Indigenous Australia. Reconciliation across the entire history of the often bloody encounter between those who emerged from the Dreamtime 1,000 generations ago and those who, like me, came across the seas only yesterday. Reconciliation which opens up whole new possibilities for the future. For the nation to bring the first two centuries of our settled history to a close as we begin a new chapter and which we embrace with pride, admiration and awe these great and ancient cultures we are blessed, truly blessed, to have among us. Cultures that provide a unique, uninterrupted human thread linking our Australian continent to the most ancient prehistory of our planet. And growing from this new respect to see our Indigenous brothers and sisters with fresh eyes, with new eyes, and with our minds wide open as to how we might tackle together the great practical challenges that Indigenous Australia faces in the future. So let us turn this page together, Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians, government and opposition, Commonwealth and state, and write this new chapter in our nation's story together. First Australians, First Fleeters, and those who first took the oath of allegiance just a few weeks ago, let's grasp this opportunity to craft a new future for this great land, Australia. Mr. Speaker, I commend the motion to the House.
Okay, now, if that doesn't move you, you must be dead. And before we get into the opposition's, not so much response, but his speech, Dr. Brendan Nelson, I have to read a comment. I posted the audio of all of this, not only on my blog, 12harmonic.net, but I also posted them at Tim Dunlop's roadtoserfdom.com. And while I was listening to that, a comment came through on the thread from a surfer by the name of Lady Madonna, and I think she says, I love other people's words when it comes to this. It was the greatest speech ever broadcast by anyone in Australia's history. It took great fortitude, vision, and decency to conceive, and it finally convicted this entire nation's perpetuation of one of humanity's worst ever crimes, guilty as charged. The apology was ferociously condemning of numerous past governments and agencies while blatantly blasting our most recent government as doers and ignorers of great evil. The opposition's hypocritical mimicry was abysmal and begs why they failed to utter just one of today's fine words in 11 long years. So enormous applause from all decent people throughout Australia for such a shining beacon of graciousness, and may other such nations hopefully show the fortitude to follow suit. To the USA and the genocide of its Native Americans, we challenge you to do the same or remain forever condemned by history, where not even the passage of time will forgive. And if you go to today's show post, there's a link to my blog where you can listen and download to all of this audio. But Now, before we get into, and we got to do this quick because there's not that much time, it's going to be tight. The leader of the opposition, Brendan Nelson, started off beautifully. And I wish he had researched his speech a little bit better, because the story he tells comes word for word from the Wikipedia on the Stolen Generation. You'll find a link on today's show post. But he ended up at this point turning and paying lip service to the factions in his party that did not want this, and tried to go back to the idea of with the best of intentions. And at that moment when he did that, the audience inside and the audience outside and the audience in Redfern all turned their backs on Brendan Nelson. And I hope as time passes, the beginning of his speech is what is remembered, and he moves forward with Prime Minister Rudd to help to undo the damage, so that the unfortunate comments later in this address will be forgotten. So without any wasting any more time, roll Dr. Nelson, please, Bob.
Order. The question is that the motion be agreed to. The Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, members of this, the 42nd Parliament of Australia, visitors and all Australians, in rising to speak strongly in support of this motion, I recognise the Ngunnawal, First Peoples of this Canberra land. Today our nation crosses a threshold. We formally offer an apology. We say sorry to those Aboriginal people forcibly removed from their families through the first 7 decades of the 20th century. In doing so, we reach from within ourselves to our past, those whose lives connect us to it, and in deep understanding of its importance to our future. We will be at our best today and every day if we pause to place ourselves in the shoes of others, imbued with the imaginative capacity to see this issue through their eyes with decency and respect. This chapter in our nation's history is emblematic of much of the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians from the arrival of the First Fleet in 1788. It is one of two cultures, one ancient, proud, and celebrating its deep bond with this land for some 60,000 years. The other, no less proud, arrived here with little more than visionary hope, deeply rooted in gritty determination to build an Australian nation, not only for its early settlers and Indigenous peoples, but those who would increasingly come from all parts of the world. Whether Australian by birth or immigration, each one of us as Australians, has a duty to understand and respect what has been done in our name. In most cases, we do with great pride, but in others, it is with shame. In brutally harsh conditions, from the small number of early British settlers, our non-Indigenous ancestors have given us a nation the envy of any in the world. But Aboriginal Australians made involuntary sacrifices, different but no less important, to make Australia the economic and social development that we see of our country today. None of this was easy. We cannot, from the comfort of the 21st century, begin to imagine what they overcame, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to give us what we have and make us who we are. We do know, though, that language, disease, ignorance, good intentions, basic human prejudices, and a cultural and technological chasm combined to deliver a harshness exceeded only by the land over which each sought to prevail. And as our young nation celebrated its federation, formality emerged in arrangements and laws that would govern the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. The new nation's constitution, though, would not allow for the counting of natives or for the Commonwealth to pass laws in relation to Aborigines. Protection boards and reserves were established. Aborigines in some jurisdictions were excluded from public schools. Episodic violence in race relations continued. Assimilation underwrote emerging policies, and churches heeded their Christian doctrine to reach out to people whom they saw as being in desperate need. Though disputed in motive and detail, and with varying recollections of events by others, the removal of Aboriginal children began. In some cases, government policies evolved from the belief that the Aboriginal race would not survive and should be assimilated. In others, the conviction was that half-caste children, in particular, should, for their own protection, be removed to government and church-run institutions where conditions reflected the standards of the day. Others were placed with white families whose kindness motivated them to the belief that rescued children deserved a better life. Our responsibility, every one of us, is to understand what happened here, why it happened, the impact that it had not only on those who were removed, but also those who did the removing and those who supported it. Our generation does not own these actions, nor should it feel guilt for what was done in many, but certainly not all cases, with the best of intentions. But in saying we are sorry, and deeply so, we remind ourselves that each generation lives in ignorance of the long-term consequences of its decisions and its actions. Even when motivated by inherent humanity and decency to reach out to the dispossessed in extreme adversity, our actions can have unintended consequences. As such, many decent Australians are hurt by accusations of theft in relation to their good intentions. The stories are well documented, and I thank the Prime Minister for reminding us of Lorna Fijo's experience. I will repeat two. The first was a submission given to the Human Rights Inquiry into this, and I quote, "I was at the post office with my mum and auntie and cousin. They put us in the police ute and said they were taking us to Broome. They put the mums in there as well, but when we'd been gone about 10 miles, they stopped and threw the mothers out of the car. We jumped on our mothers' backs, crying, trying not to be left behind, but the policemen pulled us off and threw us back in the car. They pushed the mothers away and drove off, while our mothers were chasing the car, running and crying after us. We were screaming in the back of that car. When we got to Broome, they put me and my cousin in the Broome lockup. We were only 10 years old. We were in the lockup for 2 days, waiting for the boat to Perth." In his Black Oral History, which I commend to every Australian, The Wailing, Stuart Rintoul records the pain, the thin pain, of an Aboriginal woman from Walgett. And I quote, "Something else that never left my mind, my memory, was of a family of children being taken away, and this little girl, she must have been about the same age as myself. I suppose she might have been about 6. But I can still see that little person on the back of the mission truck with a little rag hat on, and she went away, and we never seen her anymore. She was crying. Everyone was crying. Things like that never leave your memory." It's reasonably argued that removal from squalor led to better lives, children fed, housed and educated for an adult world of which they could not have imagined. However, from my life as a family doctor and knowing the impact of my own father's removal from his unmarried teenage mother, not knowing who you are is the source of deep, scarring sorrows, the real meaning of which can be known only to those who have endured it. No one should bring a sense of moral superiority to this debate in seeking to diminish the view that good in many cases was sought to be done. This is a complex issue. Faye Lyman's life is one of the many voices oral history at the National Library of Australia. Faye left her father when she was 8. She said this: "Personally, I don't want people to say, 'I'm sorry, Faye.' I just want them to understand. It was very hurtful to leave Dad. Oh, it broke my heart. Dad said to me, 'It's hard for Daddy, and the authorities won't let you stay with me in a tent on the riverbank. You're a little girl, and you need someone to look after you.' I remember him telling us that, and I cried, and I said, 'No, but Dad, you look after us.' But they kept telling us it wasn't the right thing." She went on, "I don't want people to say sorry. I just want them to understand the hurt, what happened when we were initially separated, and just understand the society, that what they have done, you don't belong in either world. I can't explain it. It hurts so much." There is no compensation fund for this, nor should there be. How can any sum of money replace a life deprived of knowing your family? Separation was then, and remains today, a painful but necessary part of public policy in the protection of children. Our restitution for this lies in our determination to address today's injustices, learning from what was done, and doing everything we can to heal those who suffered. The period within which these events occurred was one that defined and shaped Australia. The governments that oversaw this and those who elected them emerged from federating the nation to a century characterised for Australia as triumph in the face of extraordinary adversities unknown to our generation. In offering this apology, let us not, in our language and our actions, create one injustice in our attempt to address another. Let no one forget that they sent their sons to war, shaping our identity and place in the world. 100,000 in 2 wars alone gave their lives in our name and our uniform, lying forever in distant lands, silent witnesses to the future that they have given us. Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians lie alongside one another. These generations considered their responsibilities to their country and one another more important than their rights. They didn't buy something till they'd saved up for it, and values were far more important than value. Living in considerably more difficult times, they had dreams for our nation, but little money. Theirs was a mesh of values enshrined in God, King, and country, and the belief in something greater than yourself. Neglectful indifference to all that they have achieved, while seeing their actions in the separations only, through the values of our comfortable, modern Australia, will be to diminish ourselves. Today our nation pauses to reflect on this chapter of relations between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australia. In doing so, however, given that there are so many Australians who perhaps unusually today are focused on Aboriginal issues, spare a thought for the real, immediate, seemingly intractable and disgraceful circumstances in which many Indigenous Australians find themselves today. As we meet and speak in this Parliament, Aboriginal Australians continue to die long before the rest of us. Alcohol, welfare without responsibilities, isolation from the economic mainstream, corrupt management of resources, nepotism, political buck passing between governments with divided responsibilities, lack of home ownership, under-policing, and tolerance by authorities of neglect and abuse of children that violates all for which we stand, all combine to see too many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people living lives of existential aimlessness. Indigenous life expectancy is still stubbornly 17 years less than for non-Indigenous Australians. A baby born while we speak, an Aboriginal baby, still has only a 1 in 3 chance of seeing the age of 65. Diabetes, kidney disease, hospitalisation of women from assault, imprisonment, overcrowding in housing, educational underperformance and unemployment remain appallingly high, despite gains in some areas over the past decade. Annual Indigenous-specific spending by the Commonwealth has reached $3.5 billion a year, plus $500 million this year on the Northern Territory intervention. The sexual abuse of Aboriginal children was found in every one of the 45 Northern Territory communities surveyed for the Little Children Are Sacred report. It was the straw that broke the camel's back, driving the Howard government's decision to intervene with a suite of dramatically radical welfare, health and policing initiatives. I can't imagine the strength upon which she drew, but the Alice Springs Crown Prosecutor Nanette Rogers, with great courage, revealed to the nation in 2006 the case of a 4-year-old girl drowned while being raped by a teenager who had been sniffing petrol. She told us of the two children, one a baby, sexually assaulted by two men while their mothers were drinking alcohol. Another baby was stabbed by a man trying to kill her mother. So too, a 10-year-old girl was gang raped in Aurukun, the offenders going free, barely punished. A boy was raped in another community by other children. Is this not an emergency? The most disturbing part of it being its endemic nature and Australia's apparent desensitisation to it. Yet governments responsible for delivering services and security have resisted elements of a Northern Territory-style intervention. I ask the Prime Minister to report to this Parliament regularly on what his government is doing to save this generation of Aboriginal Australians from these appalling conditions. I also offer, on behalf of the Opposition, my unconditional support to participate in the Commission for Policy which he proposes. This is far, far more important than any of the things that would normally divide us as a nation in philosophy and politics. Our generation has, over 35 years, overseen a system of welfare, alcohol delivery, administration of programs, episodic preoccupation with symbolism, and at times even excusing the inexcusable in the name of cultural sensitivity to create what we now see in remote Aboriginal Australia. With good intentions, perhaps like earlier generations, we have, under successive governments, created lives in many cases of misery for which we might apologise. I certainly do. The best way we can show it is to act, and to act now. I challenge anyone who thinks Aboriginal people get a good deal to come to any of these communities and tell me you wish you had been born there. The first Aboriginal Australian who came to this Parliament was Neville Bonner, a Yungara man abandoned by his non-Aboriginal father before his birth on Yukabar Island in the mouth of the Tweed River. Neville was born into a life of hardship known only to some who are here today as visitors. He grew up in a hollow that had been carved by his grandfather under lantana bushes. The year before his mother's death, when he was 9, she sent him to a school near Lismore. He lasted 2 days before the non-Aboriginal people forced his exclusion. It was to his grandmother Ida he attributed his final success. Arguing at 14 that the boy must go to school, she had said to him, "Neville, if you learn to read and write, express yourself well, and treat people with decency and courtesy, it will take you a long way." And it did. Through a life as a scrub clearer, a ringer, a stockman, a bridge carpenter, and 11...
We're running out of time, and you get the point there. Unfortunately, Brendan Nelson went completely off the rails and suddenly had to bring up the Anzacs, World War I and World War II veterans, as though this was the same issue, or, you know, why are we focusing on this when there are all these people? Well, you know what? We have Anzac Day. We have Remembrance Day. Every single bloody club in this country has a minute of silence every single day. How dare he? And he wonders why people turned their backs on him while once he went this direction. He opened up so beautifully. He should have stuck to the subject and the point of the day. That whole thing of the best of intentions, that's straight out of the Howard Handbook and his concept of, you know, the black armband version of history. John Howard tried to, engineer a curriculum here where they would whitewash the whole idea of the stolen generations. And I find these people just disgusting. There was only a couple minutes left of that crap to go, but I had to cut it off. We were running out of time. But I think what comes out of this, though, is it is a monumental day for this country. And even though this guy still had to try and do his point scoring when he said we should stop doing the point scoring, is this just not typical right-wing crap? I mean, it boggles the mind. And this is a guy who actually used to be part of the Labor Party and then switched sides. And I don't think he actually believed the stuff he was saying. I think that this all came from the right-wing racist factions of his party. He had to pay lip service to them because they are the ones who voted him into the leadership after Howard was gone. So if you need to cleanse yourself after that, go to my blog. Disregard that Google thing that it's a dangerous site. I'm going to figure out what that's all about. Thank you, Lottie. And you can go and listen to the apology in Rudd's words again. But I had to play the whole thing because it gives you a very good picture. You know, this is the government that did nothing about it for 11 years. And then this guy turns around and says, the time is now. What did you do for the past 11 years? All right, folks, we'll probably talk a little bit about this tomorrow in the fallout. So we'll see you then. Be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, tell you that sometimes it's easier to desire and pursue the attention and admiration of 100 strangers than it is to accept the love and loyalty of those closest to me. And I would tell you that sometimes I prefer to look at myself through someone else's eyes, eyes that aren't clouded with the tears of knowing what an asshole I can be. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I might be able to listen in silence to your concerns, rather than hearing everything as an accusation or an indictment against me.
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network.